superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
It's the mighty ocean.
That's the Navy hymn, and for this Veterans Day, a local veteran immortalized by a president.
The Stand To Veterans Leadership Program, we had a module in Washington, D.C., and that's when they informed me the president would be interested in painting my portrait.
We'll hear the story of Solon Springs' Kimberly Mitchell. Plus, it's a record label that got its start at a bodega on the UP.
My first band, Frostbitten Grass, he let us borrow tools from his welding shop to keep our old band van running. And he extended a line of credit to us, which a lot of times was just loaves of bread and peanut butter and Pabst Blue Ribbon beer.
We'll catch up with Matthew Sales and Philville Records. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Veterans Day is tomorrow, and there are few places better to hear the stories of local men and women who served than the Richard I. Bong Veterans History Center in Superior. It has a wealth of information and is open 7 days a week, including tomorrow's holiday. But the story of Kimberly Mitchell can be found in a bookstore or library in a volume of paintings by a president-turned-artist. Kimberly was an orphan from Vietnam who grew up in Solon Springs and made a career in the Navy and later as an aide to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. She was chosen by former President George W. Bush as a subject for his Portraits of American Immigrants series in 2021. We caught up with Kimberly when the portrait was unveiled, and in a moment we'll hear our conversation from back then. But first, courtesy of the George W. Bush Center in Dallas, the story of how a former president found a second career as an artist.
If someone had said when George and I married that he would become president, I might have said, well, maybe. He was interested in politics, and he was running for Congress in that early years of our marriage. But if someone had said, one day you'll be introducing George and talking about his paintings, I would have said, no way. George had never shown any interest in art. It all began with an iPad app called Pen Ultimate. George would sketch a little drawing on his iPad and email it to me or to the girls. In his early experiments with art, the ranch looked like this. And on a trip to Arizona, he sent his first self-portrait. Painting, even as a pastime, is serious business. It requires discipline, which makes it well-suited to George, or more to the point, George well-suited to it. George is disciplined and project-oriented. He gets his work done, and he brought that dedication to painting. Like any skill, painting takes practice, and George works a few hours every day in his studio. At the beginning, he was a pet portrait painter. He painted his parents' dogs, his sister's dogs, and his brother's dogs. And yes, they really do look like that. He painted our pets, who didn't mind posing and whose feedback consisted mostly of wagging tails or purring. But as much as George liked painting pets, he wanted to challenge himself. He began painting humans, even doing a few self-portraits. Every new painter, even a former president, finds himself asking the question, what or whom should I paint? And then there's this piece of advice given to many beginning artists. Paint what you know. As George began to think about possible subjects, he began to think about some of the people who he had found most fascinating. When he met with them, he didn't have a sketch pad in hand. He wasn't thinking about character studies or light or shadow. Yet in the hours and days that they'd spent together, he'd studied them all from a unique vantage point. Each of these men and women was someone he knew as a fellow leader. In painting the portraits of world leaders, George had both the perspective of an artist and the perspective of a president. After painting portraits of world leaders, George's instructor, Cedric Huckabee, suggested that George paint the faces of people that other people didn't know, the faces of the men and women who'd served our country. So George painted portraits of 98 wounded warriors. The portraits, along with the stories he wrote of the warriors, have been published in George's book, Portraits of Courage. I'm grateful that at last, George has a chance to develop his artistic eye. And I'm thankful for the nation that allowed us to serve it for 8 years. I'm happy to see my husband painting, and I'm pleased to introduce the artist himself, my husband, George Bush.
Good job.
Good job, darling.
Thank you all. Thank you all. So, my life has changed dramatically in the post-presidency. One reason why is I'm no longer president. Second reason why is I'm a grandfather. Third reason why is because I have become an artist. I'm proof that old dogs can learn new tricks. I'm also proof that it's important to live life to the fullest. And even though part of you says you can't do something, it's important to try.
That was former President George W. Bush, preceded by Laura Bush, telling of his journey to his new career as an artist. One of his latest subjects is one of our own. Kimberly Mitchell was born in Vietnam and is very much a product of northwestern Wisconsin, specifically Solon Springs, where she was raised by a U.S. serviceman who adopted her from an orphanage in Da Nang, Vietnam. She went on to attend and graduate Solon Springs High School, and if you think you remember her working at the local Dairy Queen, you would be right. After high school, she entered the United States Naval Academy, going on to serve in the Navy for 17 years and becoming a lieutenant commander, and eventually working for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington. Welcome to Simply Superior, Kimberly.
Thank you for inviting me, Robin.
So, Kim, President Bush has become quite known for his painting. How did he choose you?
That's a really good question, Robin, how President Bush chose me. I was actually part of the 2019 Stand to Veterans Leadership Program hosted by the George W. Bush Presidential Center. And it was during that time that I was notified that President Bush was very interested in my story and my background, where I was born, where I grew up, my service in the Navy, and that he would be interested in painting my portrait for the new project that he was doing, highlighting the achievements and contributions of America's immigrants in this book.
Mm-hmm. And he heard about your work at the Dairy Queen, too, right?
Well, I'm not sure if President Bush heard about my work at the Dairy Queen. He has heard about my work, though, in the veteran space. He and his staff do a lot of programs supporting our service members, veterans, and their families. And so he and his staff and I have crossed paths as we work through a lot of the challenges that our folks face as they reintegrate back into civil society.
Mm-hmm. I promise not to bring up the Dairy Queen too many more times. So I know that you worked in two presidential administrations. Was one of them George W. Bush's, or
yes,
which ones were
yes,
those?
Yes, I actually was a White House military social aide for both President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama.
So was yours a face that he already knew, or...
Oh, yes. I worked over 200 events while he was president. So he definitely had seen my face. He didn't know back then my personal story and my background, but we definitely had crossed paths.
Right. And you, of course, didn't think of him as an artist at the time.
Well, no, because I don't believe he started painting until after he left office. And so...
We are speaking with Kimberly Mitchell, a subject of a painting by former President George W. Bush in his Portraits of Immigrants series. So what was the actual process like? How long did you sit for the painting, or was it also from photographs?
It was actually from photographs, Robin. As I was with the Stand to Veterans Leadership Program, we had a module in Washington, D.C., and that's when they informed me. This was in September of 2019. They informed me that the president would be interested in painting my portrait. So the next day, his photographer, a gentleman named Grant Miller, pulled me aside and took a bunch of photos of me standing, sitting, kneeling, looking up, looking down, looking side to side, looking right at the camera. And so that the president would have a lot of different options to choose from, and he could choose which photograph that he would like to paint the portrait from.
Well, he's been doing this a while now, so I guess, you do that. I'm familiar with artists and people who do paint from photographs, but I hadn't thought of that, of having different angles like that to get different perspectives, because, you know, everybody is more than just their flat portrait. What was your reaction in the first place when you heard that he was interested in painting you?
I think my reaction was, he wants to do what? And me? Why me? Because, you know, Robin, I know you kind of briefly mentioned my background and my history. And yes, I was adopted from the orphanage in Da Nang. And I am a naturalized citizen. I grew up in northern Wisconsin. But it wasn't until recently that I really even considered myself an immigrant, you know, because first and foremost, I consider myself an American. That's the life that I've known. That's the life I grew up. And I'm deeply and truly honored that President Bush chose me to be one of the stories that he wanted to highlight in this book of immigrants that have succeeded here in America, that have stories that are just truly remarkable. And sometimes I feel like my story isn't, how does it compare with some of these stories that you read in the book that are just truly stories of courage and resilience and just determination. And I feel like I've been very blessed to be at the right place at the right time, and coupled with hard work to be able to get where I've gone. So I'm you know, like I said, the first time I was told, I looked at it, I said, what, me? Are you sure? So it is an honor for sure.
Right. And I think what you're saying is that, you know, the immigrant story, if you will, is not one story, right? It's extremely diverse.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we all have stories. As everyone says, we all have a story, right? But the stories of immigrants and folks coming to America in search of a better life, in search for a way to be successful and to give back to their communities and to be able to work hard and provide for their families. I mean, that's, and to become an American, right? To be, as I was watching some interviews, I think President Bush really put it eloquently when he said that, you know, when you come to America from another country and you raise your right hand and you take that oath, you are an American. For me, I have an immense sense of pride to be an American right now because of just this honor.
Mm-hmm. When you took that oath, though, you weren't that old.
No, I mean, I left Vietnam when I was 10 months old. I was a naturalized citizen when I was 5 years old. So I have a newspaper clipping from the front page of the newspaper from at Portales, New Mexico, I guess it's where it was. It was 10 immigrants becoming naturalized Americans, and I was one of them. I was the youngest one, and of course, the photographer at the time somehow zeroed in on me to be a picture on the front page of the paper.
So you've attracted photographers and artists all your life, is what you're saying.
Well, I don't know if I want to say that, but somehow I did attract attention, and that was the first time I was ever on the front page of a paper.
All right, great. We're speaking with Kimberly Mitchell, a graduate of Solon Springs High School and also the U.S. Naval Academy, and a veteran of 17 years in the Navy and then working for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and in the White House. She is the subject of a portrait by former President George W. Bush in his Portraits of Immigrants series. So the final portrait, when you saw it, what was your reaction?
I actually saw it a couple weekends ago when I traveled to Dallas to go view the portrait. And I deliberately didn't look at the book that had been sent to me because I wanted the first time in seeing the portrait to be the actual portrait. And I was slightly emotional because I think, I could tell it was me. And, I looked at it and I was like, wow. I've never had someone paint a portrait of me before. So I'm looking at it and I just had this immense sense of pride to be an American as I'm looking at this portrait amidst all these other portraits of Americans. You know, when President Bush asked me what I thought of it, I said, it's very well done. So.
Well, not every artist gets that from their subjects, believe me. There's a long history to that. And you mentioned, you were among portraits of other Americans, but he's painted people from all over the world. He started by doing some world leaders. Not all of them would necessarily be as fond of the work as you were. Not saying anything about the president. I'm saying that's what happens with art, right? You know, the artist portrays you and the way the artist portrays you.
Right.
But you don't have to be the critic, yes.
I love the portrait. And I think it's a very unique perspective because I'm not looking directly. I'm kind of looking off to the side. So I love the aspect that he chose.
Mm-hmm.
I think the title of his book, Out of Many One, right? That and we see that model all the time, E Pluribus Unum. I think it's a perfect title for his book because I think it just shows the diverse perspective that really makes up America.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to ask you to get political or anything like that, but, you know, the last 4 years, we haven't had quite the same message from the White House about immigration, or immigrants in particular. So I'll put you this much on the spot anyway to say, does this help maybe normalize the thinking? I mean, the very title that you just said, that immigrants are part of all of us.
Absolutely. I hope and pray that this does create conversation and create some understanding that we are a nation of immigrants. And so, I have always said in many of my speeches across the country is that we are stronger together when we have common goals and common dreams.
Who else is in the book?
Well, there's actually quite a few folks. I know Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is in the book. Henry Kissinger is in the book. Madeleine Albright is in the book, as well as many others. Folks that I think I saw an interview with President Bush where he kind of chose famous and not famous people is what he said. So there's a lady, and if you get the book, her name is Jean Celestine. And her story is just absolutely amazing. It actually brought me to tears when I read her story in the book. So
actually, I just looked it up online, and I'm reading here. Jean Celestine Lakin saw her entire family slaughtered in front of her at just 9 years old during the Rwandan genocide, and now shares her remarkable story of survival and forgiveness. On a much lighter note, with Arnold Schwarzenegger included, it looks like the president was concentrating at least in part on Northwest Wisconsin and the University of Wisconsin-Superior, with Arnold being a graduate.
Yes, he was at University of Wisconsin-Superior. Some of my friends remember him. And I did attend University of Wisconsin-Superior for 1 year while I was at home after my father had been struck by lightning and killed on our farm.
Oh,
in 1991, I did return home from the Naval Academy for a year to help out my family and the farm. And so while I was there, I did take classes for the year at UWS and then went back to the Naval Academy the next year. So.
Mm-hmm. And family is still here?
No. I have some aunts and uncles and cousins down in southern Wisconsin. That's about it.
In fact, did I say I was not going to mention the Dairy Queen again or that much? I'm sure you can stop by there and get a blizzard or whatever you want. We've been speaking with Kimberly Mitchell, She's a graduate of Solon Springs High School and a U.S. Naval Academy and had a 17-year career in the Navy and the subject of a portrait by former President George W. Bush in his Portraits of Immigrants series. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Robin. It's a pleasure being on the show with you today.
Coming up, Matthew Sales and friends bring their Americana to Duluth.
Everyone I was, everything that they said to be.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. If you haven't visited the UP, then you missed out on the bustling music scene there that just may be the next Nashville, or maybe not. But it is the birthplace of Philville Records, an Americana label founded in Marquette by Matthew Sales and Phil Pierce in 2000. It's moved since then, first to Ventura, California, and to his present home in Eau Claire. Phil Pierce passed away in 2018, but Matt Sales still runs it, in between performing with legends like Merle Haggard and Dwight Yoakam. And he'll be performing at Wusso's Concert Cafe in Duluth tomorrow, November 11th, along with Raymond Little, Wyatt Thompson, and Clancy Ward. And he joins me now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Robin. It's great to talk to you.
So you and your late partner, Phil Pierce, started Philville Records, which I take it is named for him, in Marquette, Michigan. Did you face competition from all those record labels on the UP?
Oh, no, man. I mean, honestly, what's pretty funny is I think Phil would be, he's probably laughing out there in the ether somewhere right now, because Phil was the proprietor of what we call in Michigan a party store, which is basically kind of like a bodega. So he would weld in the garage and ran the store, which was kind of the last stop on the way out to Big Bay, which is a tiny little community at the end of Highway 550 going north of Marquette. So Phil was a friend of mine. I'd met him years prior to me even really playing music out professionally. We were bumming motorcycle parts off of another guy named Phil in town. And Phil was, you know, he's quite a bit older than I was. So I really looked up to him, but he was a character, and I ended up renting a house across the street from his store in the early 2000s. So Phil really had, the only thing Phil helped us do in the outset, which was really important, is my first band, Frostbitten Grass, he let us borrow tools from his shop, his welding shop, to keep our old band van running. And he extended a line of credit to us at the store, which a lot of times was just loaves of bread and peanut butter and Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. And as an interesting aside, that's another great connection with why this show is kind of pulled together. Ray Little, who's coming in from Marquette for these two shows that we're doing in between Wisconsin and Minnesota. Ray also moved into that house about 10 years after I had moved out west, and he started recording there as well. So through the grapevine, I'd heard that there was another musician back in the old Philville house recording, and he and I connected, and we've been great friends ever since. And he's got his own record label in Marquette called Lost Dog Records. Yeah, so that's kind of the UP connection to all this. But I know that Phil is up there laughing somewhere, thinking that he was a vital role, but he never ran the knobs or had to do anything in the studio.
Well, you know what? It sounds like Marquette did have a bustling music scene. Two labels, at least. Yeah, still does. And
yeah,
you definitely made that story UP. I love the bodega and the snow plowing and whatever else. So that sounds more like the Marquette I know.
I mean, one of our favorite things to do when we get back late from gigs was sit out in our front porch when it wasn't too cold, and we'd watch Phil weld in his shop until 3 a.m. entertainment.
That's
in the
better than paint drying. Okay, so then you went to Ventura, California. That had to be a change, and then back here to Eau Claire. The brief version of that sojourn?
Sure. My band had a pretty good amount of success playing bluegrass at that point, but at that time in the early 2000s, none of us really thought that string band music was going to be the means of paying off our student loans or, you know, getting rich. So I decided to head out west. I've always wanted to live out in the mountains, so I was kind of going out there partially to be a ski bum in Bend, Oregon. So the rest of the guys stuck around, and we all kind of laughed because, you know, at the time we're like, oh, there's no way we're going to be, you know, successful playing, you know, bluegrass in the upper Midwest. And now you look around and you got hugely famous bands like Trampled by Turtles that we used to play with, Green Sky Bluegrass, who we started out, we played shows with down west. And now, of course, like years later, Billy Strings, who's just completely blown up. And here's another Michigan kid playing bluegrass music and is now, you know, as big as anybody's ever been in the genre. But yeah, I moved out west, toured out of Oregon for a couple years, and then moved down to Northern California for a couple years before I landed in Ventura and spent about a decade out there. And that's when the label got a lot more serious and there was a lot more work for me just because it was a much bigger music scene and a bigger market. And that's where I had a lot more success playing with some of those country legends and just kind of connecting into the LA scene.
So. And then you came back to Eau Claire.
I did. Yeah. Well, and Eau Claire was the place that I traveled through years back when I was touring with my first band, Frostbitten
Grass. We all traveled through Eau Claire.
Well, yeah, I wish I would have stopped over more because I've really fallen in love with the town. But yeah, my wife is an educator, so she was going to school in California. So she got a job here in town and that's what brought us to Eau Claire. But obviously we both, you know, being just a little bit, you know, further up the road from here in the UP years back, she'd gone to school at Northern Michigan and Marquette, just like I had. We still had a lot of friends and a lot of musical connections in Duluth. So for us, it was really natural to be that much closer to home and family and friends. And to be honest, I both of us just really miss the seasons.
Sure. Yeah. How can you do without 20 below? Come on.
Yeah, right. You got to have context, man. That much easy living, it made me soft.
Well, let's hear some of your music. How about, and this may be a Ventura story, If There's a Western Swing in Hell, and that's by the Ventucky String Band. Can you explain that and set the song up for us?
Sure. Yeah, this is a song written about a really notorious sort of dark, evil character in the annals of Western Swing. His name was Spade Cooley. I mean, the stories about Spade Cooley were notorious in the scene that I was running in because I was a huge fan of Western Swing, and the Ventucky String Band played a lot of that early kind of Bob Wills, California kind of country Western Swing from the 40s and 50s when a lot of those were in the pictures and really popular. But Spade Cooley was a hugely successful artist, had moved to California, had a huge rotation of people through his band that went on to have huge careers with Bob Wills. And then in the 1960s, everything kind of fell apart for him. He was a pretty heavy drinker. The drinking got out of hand and he lost his mind. And I don't even want to, I don't feel comfortable discussing some of the stuff that he did on the radio. But if you want to do a deeper dive, anybody wants to look it up, you can find the dark story. So that's what the premise of this song is that if there's Western Swing in Hell, it's probably Spade Cooley leading the band.
All right. Well, here is If There's a Western Swing in Hell by Matt Sales and the Ventucky String Band.
Everybody sings that Bob Wills is still the king. For every happy song, there lies a darker tune. But this tale I'm about to tell, well, it don't hardly end up well. About the other king of that California swing. An oaky fiddler born and bred, fled the Dust Bowl heading west. Formed a swinging band and got in them pictures too. But old Spade Cooley didn't know that devil honed his soul, and he was booked for runner shows in the fires below. Lay it down with Jimmy Tex, Deuce and Smokey too. They own Venice Beach by right, then pack that ballroom every night. Even old Bob Wills saw fit to pay tribute. But old Spade was doing wrong, and it didn't take too long for that devil to come and claim his mortal soul. Well, if there's Western Swing in Hell, every fiddler knows too well Spade Cooley, he's the leader of that band. One sad and twisted night, Spade Cooley killed his wife. An awful crime, murder first degree. Well, they haul him off to jail to sit in a lonely cell and think about his vile and dreadful deeds.
He'd been serving near 10 years. That parole board had him clear. He was set to be released in just 4 months. But that devil's a tough boss, and he was feeling at a loss. And it took old Spade before they'd let him free. Cause old Spade was doing wrong, and it didn't take too long for that devil to come and claim his mortal soul. Yeah, if there's western swinging hell, every fiddler knows too well Spade Cooley, he's the leader of that band.
And that was If There's a Western Swing in Hell by Matt Sales with the Ventucky String Band. Matt will be performing at Wusel's Concert Cafe in Duluth tomorrow, November 11th at 7 p.m., along with Raymond Little, Wyatt Thompson, and Clancy Ward. So let's talk about your label a little bit. How do you define Americana? It seems like a lot of guests on our show who don't sound anything like each other use that term.
I know it's unfortunate. And honestly, I wish I didn't even have to come up with a label for it. It's kind of a catch-all for so many different things that I think some artists hate being lumped into it. If you remember back in the 90s when people just started calling it was alternative music, and it's like, well, alternative to what? And, you know, and Americana is the same kind of thing. Is it could be anything from straight up country rooted stuff all the way through blues. And I think roots music is probably more appropriate to what a lot of the sound that I'm going for with the label is. It's more earlier aspects of the, you know, the beginnings of country music, old time music, black music, spiritual gospel, all the way up into like the beginnings of, you know, rock and roll, out of the boogie woogie into the 60s and 70s. And the sound that, you know, at least most of the artists that are on my label that I'm trying to cultivate are really kind of focused in that era between, you know, the 20s and about the 1970s. So kind of the hippie counterculture movement when there was sort of the folk revivals and some of those revivalists that came out in the 70s that were really kind of playing and having fun and just kind of twisting around folk music, but not neglecting what's been happening in rock and roll and other things that were going on at the same time too. Of course, the Dead were always playing with that. Dylan was putting on a different character for almost every album that he put out in that era too.
Well, I was going to ask, if one of your artists suddenly puts out a hip hop tune or classical or both or something, and people do that, right? And it's really good. Do you say no thanks?
Oh, I don't know. I'd be so lucky if somebody wanted to approach me to play any genre outside. I know my wheelhouse is, because most of what I do, I do a lot of engineering and producing with it as well. So my ear is drawn and I have a lot more experience in making old-time string bands, bluegrass bands, and kind of country western, all the way to kind of like slightly psychedelic stuff, more 50s, 60s, 70s kind of rock and country. I can handle that. You know, you get into R&B with a lot of like program beats and stuff like that. That's way out of my wheelhouse, man. Like I
well, don't do it just because I said that. You know,
No. It's deliberate. I'm really finding a style and a genre that I like. And then just trying to cultivate artists that have that similar sensibility. And so when people listen to a Philville Records recording, they're going to be like, oh, even if they haven't heard of the artist, they're going to be like, well, I like these other artists. There's a pretty good chance I'm going to like this too.
So briefly tell us who are some of the artists.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, Wyatt Thompson, who's on the show, and Clancy Ward, who are playing the show as well. Clancy's got a wonderful band. He's in a bunch of different projects in Duluth. He's an amazing fiddle player, bass player, multi-instrumentalist. So Clancy and his band Sugar on the Roof recorded a single with me down here in Eau Claire last year. We put that out in a 7-inch lathe cut vinyl, which is pretty cool. It's on an old machine that cuts in real time 7-inch singles. This machine was built in the late 1940s. So that's been a great connection with Clancy. I met him through the music scene through a great friend of mine, Mississippi Mike Wolf, who's a San Francisco expat that ended up in Duluth.
Well,
and
he
we
had a little Mississippi in that background, too. So.
He does. Yeah, he does. Although I think he actually was raised in Louisiana.
Oh, that's so what it was. Right. He's been on a show.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. And then Wyatt Thompson, who is one of the newest artists that I've got on Philville, is a really great younger talent. He's in his mid-20s. He's here from Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire area, and kind of defines what I was talking about with that sort of corral around the sound that I'm trying to keep, is that he's writing new music, but he's got so much of his you know, background rooted, whether it's through reincarnation or something.
All right, well, let's hear one of your cuts with Clancy Ward, Sister Kate.
So nice. All the boys in the neighborhood, well, they knew Kate could shimmy, and it's understood. I may be late, but I'll be up to date when I can shimmy like my sister Kate. Oh yeah, shimmy like my sister Kate.
Sister Kate by Matt Sales, playing with Clancy Ward. And who is Sister Kate's sister?
Oh, well, this is Sugar on the Roof, and it's Meg Reynolds, mm-hmm. and her husband Jefferson Reynolds. Megan singing, and then Jefferson's playing trombone, and I'm very much just in the background sliding around on a dobro, and a buddy of mine, Jared Kaczynski's playing bass on the track too.
And Clancy Ward on violin. And if you don't know what this shimmy is, I'm not going to tell you, but I will say that Tina Turner got it on the airwaves 40 years ago, so we should be okay. We're speaking with Matt Sales, both as a musician and the proprietor of Philville Records. Where can we learn more about your music?
Sure. You can just go to philvillerecords.com. That's P-H-I-L-V-I-L-L-E. And you'll be able to find all the artists there, downloadable tracks, video clips, all that fun stuff. There's a kind of a news segment too, where you can kind of keep up, and email sign up list if you want to get some discounts and deals. I'm really starting to branch out into doing more vinyl, short run vinyls, lathe cut vinyl records, which are exciting because they're limited and they're very collectible. And it seems to be which I never thought I'd live long enough to see vinyl records come back in the way that they are. But, you know, it's interesting.
As long as 8-tracks don't come back, I'm cool.
You know, I'm still, people I see at punk rock shows are selling cassettes still. So who knows, man? It's not impossible.
How about one more to take us out? Can't track myself down. That was an accident. I didn't know I was going to talk about tracks, but tell us about that.
Yeah, this was a song that I did with one of the larger country bands. We were named the Detroit Sportsman's Congress, which was named after a gun club that I had my first job at age 13. But we had an accordion player in the band, pedal steel, electric guitar, keyboards, drums. And we're really trying to just kind of go for sort of a West Coast honky-tonk, like one of those last great sort of dance bands.
All right. We've been speaking with Matt Sales. He'll be performing at Wusel's Concert Cafe in Duluth tomorrow, Saturday, November 11th at 7 p.m., along with Raymond Little, Wyatt Thompson, and Clancy Ward, all of whom you can hear on Philville Records, I now know. Thank you for joining us, Matt.
Yeah, thanks so much, Robin. I appreciate everything you do.
Said I'd running from what was home. Try to step back in those years before. My mind lies tattered on the ground. Yeah, I can't track myself down. Every mile marker, every time lapse light slips away a different height. In my years find common ground. All my friends can't track themselves down. Everyone I was, everything that they said to be, floats across the ether like a dancing tumble. Signposts all around, yet I can't track myself down.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And Shelley Nelson of the Superior Telegram. Hello, Shelley.
Hello, Robin.
So, Rick, the big news in Duluth this week is the election of a new mayor, as well as new and continuing faces on the city council and school board. What's the rundown, starting with the mayor?
Yes, Roger Reiner will be the city's next mayor after defeating Mayor Emily Larson on Tuesday night. The two longtime DFLers squared off against each other in the tightest mayoral race since Don Ness faced Charlie Bell back in 2007. Despite running against an incumbent, Reiner emerged as a political favorite in the race after a strong August primary performance in which he garnered 63% of the vote to Larson's 35%. Larson managed to narrow that gap slightly in the general election this week, shrinking that margin as Reiner received 60% of the vote to her 40%. According to unofficial results released Tuesday, Larson received her party's endorsement while Reiner decided not to seek it, noting that local races need not be partisan contests. This mayoral race will go down as Duluth's most expensive campaign to date, with spending through late October topping $466,000. And political action committees in support of both candidates contributing significant sums of money in support of each camp. 53-year-old Reiner has a political career that dates back to 2004. That was when he was appointed to the Duluth City Council to fill a vacancy left by newly elected Mayor Herb Bergson. His colleagues elected him to serve as council president in 2006 and 2008. In 2008, he successfully ran for the Minnesota House of Representatives. In 2010, Reiner was elected to the Minnesota Senate, where he served two terms. Reinert is an attorney and commander in the U.S. Navy Reserve. 50-year-old Larson was seeking her third term as Mayor of Duluth. Her political career started in 2011 when she emerged as a top vote-getter in the Duluth City Council at-large race. In 2015, she was elected mayor, succeeding Don Ness in that role. Larson handily won two previous mayoral races, receiving 72% of the vote against opponent Chuck Horton in 2015 and receiving nearly 64% of the vote against David Knoll in 2019. But a third term as mayor will elude Larson. She delivered a concession speech at Bent Paddle Brewing Company shortly after 9:30 p.m. on Tuesday. She told supporters that this is a very difficult job, and although we ran against one another and competed fiercely about our ideas, I truly wish him well. Reinert has pledged to bring a new leadership team to City Hall and said that the people have spoken. He told supporters that the closing argument was very simple. If people thought we were moving in the right direction, they were going to vote for a third term. But if they had concerns and they wanted to see something different, this was the first meaningful race for mayor they had in 20 years.
All right. And the council races?
Yes. In the at-large race for city council, the winners were Eric Forsman with 35% of the vote and Lynn Marie Nephew with 28%. In District 1, Wendy Durocher defeated Timothy Meyer 52% to 46%. In District 3, Roz Randorf ran unopposed. And District 4, Tara Swenson topped Howie Hansen 58% to 40%. In District 5, Janet Kennedy easily won over Ginka Tarnowski 64% to 34%. In the at-large school board race, Stephanie Williams narrowly defeated Alana Oswald 52% to 45%. District 2, Sarah Mikasel ran unopposed. And in District 3, Henry Banks slipped past Lauren Martell 50% to 48%.
All right. Well, Shelley, there were no major elections in our part of Wisconsin, but Superior and Douglas County officials are taking a look at the child care crisis.
Yeah, this week the Superior City Council followed the recommendation of a committee of county board supervisors and city councilors to award about $42,000 in grants. They'll go to child care providers in Superior, Poplar, Lake Nebagamon, and South Range for a variety of projects that will improve the environment of their child care facilities. The interesting thing about this grant is that some of the funding is actually going towards projects that will allow child care providers in the city of Superior to expand by about 30 slots for toddlers in their child care facilities.
And I am sure they are needed. Well, if you're listening to this on a smart speaker or otherwise on the internet, you'll be happy to know that Superior is moving ahead with plans to create a municipal fiber optic broadband network touted to reach every home and business in Superior.
Yeah, so the Superior City Council this week created a new utility for the first time in decades, specifically so they can create this broadband network. The council also approved a contract to do the design for the initial neighborhood where they will begin the broadband build-out. And for some residents in the city of Superior, that's good news because while they may live in the city of Superior, they're out of the reach of Spectrum and the service they provide is subpar. 10 megabits per second speeds that rarely show up as that. So that's good news for folks who currently don't have good options.
Right. And again, if you're tuning in on the web, you know how important that speed is. We've been speaking with Shelley Nelson, reporter for the Superior Telegram. Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you.
And Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org, SuperiorTelegram.com, and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with more of the music of Matthew Sales. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
A simple time, easy path to share. Few shown marks, a blank, and it ain't there. Dreamed your smile for a little while. Woke up yesterday, and I found out that a but this trail seems so sure. Can't expect a chance of perfect.